And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It is 4 minutes past nine, the start of another week, Monday the 30th of September 2024. Last day of the month, isn't it? I think it's 30 days has September, however the poem goes anyway. It's great to have you on board, be that as it may. We are here for the next 3 hours, keeping you informed and entertained, hopefully, with a big mix of topics and discussion points for you. And as always, we want you involved in that conversation or to start your own. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number. You can give us a call on 0749 125000 or email comments at highlandradio.com. And of course, you can use those contacts, emails and WhatsApps. If you're listening to the podcast or if you are listening overnight, feel free to get involved in the conversation. We don't have to be live for you to have your say. We pick those comments up later. And if you want to choose to watch us, if you're at home today, why would you head out in that awful, dark, damp weather? Stick us on your smart TV or your Fire Stick using the YouTube app and watch your local radio station live there. We're also on the X platform as well, of course, and on our Facebook channels. The Derry People Donegal News this morning talks of a petition launched to save the oak tree. Oak Gate continues apace. A campaign to save a 90-year-old oak tree in Letterkenny has moved up a gear with the launch of a petition calling on Donegal County Council to halt plans to cut down the tree. The petition named, I'm not sure it's Donegal County Council, it's not the TEI, who'd be responsible for that. But anyway, I don't know. I shouldn't say if I'm not sure. But anyway, the petition named Stop the Removal of the Historic Cecil Oak Tree in Ballyrain aims to protest a cherished landmark that has stood for nearly a century. The oak tree, located between Ballyrain Park and Orchard Grove, faces removal to make way for a new cycle path as part of the Letterkenny Active Travel Project, a decision that stirred considerable opposition with the local community. Residents, environmental advocates and members of Antashka Donegal Local Association have rallied together in protest, voicing their concerns about the council's decision. Will it stay or will it go? It'll be interesting, and it would be useful from the council's perspective or the TEI to actually come out and explain verbally why it has to be cut down. Is it simply just for a cycle path? Because if that's all it is, people might say, well, you could reroute it or do something different. Is it about part of wider plans, you know, to widen the road, to ease traffic for the local residents? Is there ongoing works in that regard? It would be really useful at this time, a useful intervention for someone to actually come on and explain what the plan is. You know, and there's obviously a benefit versus a cost, the cost being the tree. What is the benefit really in real terms? Is it just a cycle path? Because that in and of itself just sounds like a bad trade-off. Or is there more to it? As I say, I think it'd be very much in the interest of whomever is responsible who has knowledge of that just to let us know exactly what's going to be happening and why this tree is on death row. The Derry News this morning, Leo Varadkar has urged all parties contesting the forthcoming general election in the Republic of Ireland to put more money into the Shared Island Fund to improve facilities, including Ulster University McGee campus. The former Taoiseach, and that's quite an interesting statement here because he was in a position of power. The former Taoiseach, who stepped down earlier this year, outlined that idea and a series of other proposals to be addressed as he addressed school children at an event in Derry hosted as part of the SDLP's New Ireland Commission initiative. On to the Nationals now, and of course all talk is about Budget 25, which is going to be unveiled tomorrow, but for those of you who liked the excitement of what might be in it, those days are gone now because it's pretty much thrashed out in the media before it is formally announced. But what we do know is €2 billion cost of living package agreed as finishing touches are put to Budget 25. Government leaders last night agreed a major increase in the value of the cost of living package, which will be a series of one-off payments and could include two double payments of child benefit. And I think that one's locked in at this stage. How does that make you feel running up to Christmas? You know, if you are a struggling family, regardless of politics and who does it, but if you're struggling and you're wondering how you're going to make ends meet and if you're going to have certain visitors over the Christmas period and what have you, you know, if you know that you're going to get help with your electricity bill and you're going to get two double child benefit payments, that presumably is really, really welcome news. There are ongoing discussions between the government leaders over the core welfare rates, with Fine Gael sources insisting a decision had not been made on increases. However, senior Fianna Fáil figures said the coalition agreed all rates would increase by €12 a week. So if you are on a state payment at the moment, it's going to increase by €12 per week. Now, hopefully, we don't see a rent rise for those of people who are in social housing. Often, a lot of these increases, your means tested then, and you're deemed to be able to pay more rent, and the rent increase can often eat into that. So hopefully that's not the case this year. Social Protection Minister Heather Humphreys had called for all rates apart from the job seekers allowance for the long-term unemployed to be increased by €15 a week. Taoiseach Simon Harris said he incisively agrees with Ms Humphreys' proposal to increase the pension, carers allowance and disability payment at a higher rate than the job seekers allowance. However, he added he understood the view that all rates increased by the same amount in the last four budgets. The coalition leaders last night held talks with Finance Minister Jack Chambers, Public Expenditure Minister Pascal O'Donoghue and Social Protection Minister Heather Humphreys to put the final touches on tomorrow's budget. So what are some of the highlights we're expecting to see? I've mentioned many of them now. But anyway, there's going to be more money for Gardaí, funding to hire up to 1,000 Gardaí. Apparently, €250 energy credit will be taken off electricity bills of every home in the country. There's talk of two of those. There's going to be a one-off €1,000 reduction in college fees. That's also on the cards. A new tax on vapes and e-cigarettes. I thought that would have come in 3 or 4 years ago, but it's only coming in now. €12 in the weekly rates for people who are in receipt of state pension. School books for both primary and secondary schools will be free again. That could help. Struggling families there. There's also talk of increases in living alone allowances and some other allowances there. But obviously, you know, who takes credit for the budget? And it comes down to often which department. So, you know, if Fine Gael of Social Welfare and Fianna Fáil of Teaching, you know, there's a battle on there between the parties as well for the hearts and minds of the public. So in the Mail this morning, apparently there's unease rising in Fianna Fáil over fears the party is losing out in the budget battle and that Social Protection Minister Heather Humphreys is gobbling up the €3 billion bonanza. Concern is especially high in areas including education, where Minister Norma Foley is coming under political pressure to deliver a massive 37.5% increase in capitations. One senior Fianna Fáil source warns that there's a problem here and that Fine Gael TD, Ms Humphreys and the Greens are gobbling up all the money. They added parents are unhappy about buses and school costs. Norma and Micheál Martin need to stand up more effectively to Heather. They need to show they are there. The unease has increased following a stark warning to Ms Foley from an unprecedented alliance of 10 primary school groups that schools will struggle to stay open if they do not secure a €75 increase in capitation. So it's a difficult time for opposition parties are supposed to try and get headlines and to make headway around budget time, because obviously whoever is in power and when there is money to be spent, it's always going to look favourable for them. But Sinn Féin have put some information out there. It's reported in the Times today. The means test for the carers allowance would be abolished under a Sinn Féin government, party leader Mary Lou McDonald has said, which would be welcomed by many. The Dublin Central TD used her address to the party's Ardesh in Athlone on Saturday to announce this significant change to policy, which was not included in Sinn Féin's alternative budget when it was published on Thursday. Caring is work, she said, done with love, saving the state billions. It's unfair that carers allowance is means tested. I want to be very clear, in government, Sinn Féin would abolish the means test for carers allowance, she said, to sustained applause from the hall. Extending the allowance to all the estimated 500,000 people who care for people in Irish society would cost hundreds of millions. Generally, those with incomes under €450 a week after tax can qualify for the allowance worth €249 per week. But Sinn Féin says they'd abolish means test for carers allowance. What's dominated? There's this snapshot poll where it asks voters what they're worried about. And at the moment, it's housing, the bike shed and immigration. The bike shed is worrying everyone. Housing, 77%, and immigration, I think it's 60%. 86%. Sorry, the writing's tiny. So there you are. But the bike shed is on everybody's mind. Just goes to show the relatively little things that that motivate people there. Very sad news from Mayo over the weekend. Tributes poured in yesterday for a young man and boy killed in a horrific car crash on Friday night. Harry Fagan was just 19 and James Daniels, 13. They died when the car they were travelling in collided with a tractor on the N83 in County Mayo. A third occupant of the car, a boy aged 15, was seriously injured, and it's understood he underwent surgery at Mayo's University Hospital on Saturday. The driver of the tractor, a man aged in his 50s, is being treated for non-life-threatening injuries. Fine Gael councillor Alma Gallagher said the community of Clunfad, which is on the Mayo-Roscommon border, where the deceased were from, is absolutely devastated. And two handsome young boys pictured in that paper today. Unfortunately as well, they have a picture of the scene of the crash. It's not something I'm interested in looking at, but very, very sad news, and our thoughts with everyone affected. God knows we know what all that feels like. On to the Sun this morning, and apparently tougher sentences for anyone convicted of knife crime offences come into effect today. Minister for Justice Helen McEntee announced she's signed a new law which will allow maximum penalties for certain knife-related crimes. There will now be four offences under the new law which can be punishable by maximum sentences. The possession of a knife in a public place with intent to cause injury to incapacitate or intimidate a person will now increase from 5 to 7 years. It'll be interesting to see, because you often see wee videos of people holding knives and machetes. It'll be interesting to see how this is enforced. The offence of trespass with a knife, weapon or offence, or another article which has a blade or sharp point has also increased from 5 to 7 years, and on it goes. So we'll see how that goes. And more, you know, are listening to podcasts. According to the Mirror, podcasts are becoming almost as popular as TV, with almost 3 out of 4 people listening each week. A survey revealed the average listener tunes in for 48 minutes per day, with comedy and entertainment at 46%, true crime at 35%, self-help and well-being at 33%. They're the most popular genre. While sport is the favourite topic for men, just 9% of women tune into that. The survey also found middle-aged and older people are more interested in news and current affairs, and younger people less so. The survey by Pure Telecom, to coincide with International Podcast Day, shows 72% of the Irish population listen to podcasts, which is really quite significant. And hopefully many of them are the podcasts to this show, which is available from 12:30 every day in 3 parts. 086 60 25,000, that's the WhatsApp and text number for the show. Now, many of you will have noticed there's certain places you can go where cash is just simply not accepted. The Three Arena springs to mind, but also it can be locally when you're going to try and support your local team. Independent Donegal Deputy Thomas Pringle has been speaking about this. He believes cashless venues and businesses severely disadvantage some people more than others. He joins us to tease this out. Good morning, Thomas. Thanks for your time.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. So how far do you want to go? Well, I suppose, we'll start with your more local example. Was it you or someone who supports you that attended a football match recently? Was that yourself?
No, it wasn't me. I was at the match, all right. But
right,
okay. I paid with a card to attend the game, but I do know of some people who attended, who came to the game, wanted to pay with cash and weren't allowed pay with cash to enter the game. And that's wrong. Like, and it shouldn't be happening. And indeed, there's people I know that would be avid GAA supporters that attend games regularly, but on a point of principle, won't go to a game where they have to, can only pay with card. And that shouldn't happen. And you know, cash is legal tender, and it is still legal tender in Ireland, although you mightn't think so. And so cash should be accepted everywhere that there is a charge to enter, and that's the reality of it. And it's up to organisations and companies and stuff like that there to handle that cash and to be able to do that. And that's what they should be doing, and that's what it should be law for everybody to do now.
Yeah, I spoke to Mary Coughlin soon after she headed up the announcers, the chair of Donegal GEA here, and put that point to her, and she says there was no real, you know, appetite as such to provide cash options. They can do it when they want to and what have you, but there was questions over governance and that type of stuff, and that in some cases the card's the way to go. So there doesn't seem to be any move within this county, if we're taking sport as the example, to have cash accepted at all GEA games. You would like that mandated, would you? That especially, I suppose, you can make the argument that so much state funding goes into the GEA.
Well, it's not only the GA, but it's in every business and organisation should be accepting cash, because cash is legal tender. And whether there's an appetite or not for the acceptance of cash, cash should be accepted. And that's the reality of the situation. I know, for example, around Dublin, stuff like that, there's coffee shops and stuff like that that just refuse to take cash. And if you go in there to try to buy a cup of coffee, they won't take cash, and you won't get your coffee. And that's just wrong. And it's not. And there's quite a lot of people. I get representations here in the office quite regularly from people who aren't able to use cash or aren't able to use card and aren't willing to change either, and don't see why they should have to change. And I would have to agree with them. You know, if the state wants to move to a totally cashless society and stuff like that, there, that might come over time, but while that's coming on and while cash is still legal tender, it has to be facilitated and it has to be taken, and that's the way it should be.
Well, this government has made a number of moves in that regard, mandating. I'm not sure if it's introduced or they plan to introduce that cash is taken in certain places. It must be taken in certain places. The likes of that sell groceries and others. I don't have the list off the top of my head. So you would like them to go further with that then, so that anywhere where money is accepted, that cash must be accepted too.
Yeah, I think so. There is businesses say that they have difficulty in dealing with cash and it costs expensive for them and stuff like that there. But that's the reality of the situation, is cash is what's accepted for paying and it's legal tender. So therefore they have to do it. And the legislation going through the Dáil last week and the Finance Provision of Access to Cash Infrastructure Bill, which is about making sure that the central bank would actually enforce that banks accept cash and stuff like that there as well. And I know there is as well businesses that charge actually for lodging cash into the bank, which seems to be counterintuitive, and it's been about for a long time. But that should be dealt with as well. Banks' role and purpose is to provide money and provide money handling for society, or supposedly that's their role and purpose anyway. And so they should be doing that, and that should be the way it is. And you shouldn't be like, and either some banks that won't accept cash on certain days of the week and that there as well. And that's just wrong. We are a society that uses cash, and people are entitled to use it, and they should be facilitated to do so.
But I think naturally we eventually will stop using cash. The majority of people will. There's a lot of young people coming through who just prefer to tap, that use the watch, their phone, whatever it might be. And there are some young people as well, I'm sure the mums and dads of them are going, no, my kid's different, that have been taught the value of cash, and they believe, the parents believe it's good that they handle it, and then they have a better understanding of it. The reason why it's sort of, and you focused on the GEA a bit in your press release, but why I did as well is our progression forward is leaving some people behind. As I say, this is probably going to happen naturally, but we've been contacted by older people who aren't on the internet that want to go and see football matches, as an example. They're not going to the Three Arena to see Lewis Capaldi, right? They want to go and watch a football match, and they don't want to ask the nephew and niece to do it online, or they're not near a centre or wherever tickets might be sold. And I think you talked to this a little earlier on. They simply don't go to the matches.
Yeah.
And there are other options, GEA Go, and they don't have the internet for that either. Sorry, Thomas.
Yeah, but that has happened, Greg. And I know people that just won't go to matches where all that is accepted is cash or is a text card payment. They just won't go. And it's not right. And especially for people, and there's very many people that don't want to use card or that maybe don't have the facilities to use card, but are quite happy to use cash, and they should be facilitated. And if it comes to a stage where 95% of people or 100% of people want to use cash or want to use card payments in the future, well, that's fair enough. And the government can change the legislation to make sure that cash isn't acceptable as legal tender anymore. But when cash is acceptable, then the organisations have to have to accept it, and shops and businesses, and indeed even the banks as well should be accepting cash too. Like, I mean, and that's what the government needs to make sure that happens from now on as well.
A caller says, is it illegal to refuse cash? I think it has to be. I think the person has to be made aware prior to a transaction, but it's not illegal to refuse cash, is it?
I don't think it's fully illegal, but I mean, the problem is how do you enforce it? And the problem is, like, I mean, who do you get to actually enforce the acceptance of cash? Because it's not something that you can go to the guards about or anything out there as well. Like, you know, and the time that it takes, and it should be the cash is legal tender. If it should be, the understanding should be from everybody that it's accepted, and that's it. Like.
You also mentioned, and I'm reading between the lines here because I'm not quite sure what it is, but I presume that the public have free access to cash, the provision of access to cash infrastructure bill. Does this mean that something is being put in place that means that if we want to take cash from ATM, we won't find ourselves in a position that you'll have to pay every time that you do so?
Yeah, that's right. What's happened now is that the banks have offloaded and sold off the ATM machines to private companies. Basically, if you go to use a machine now, the private company charges you for use of that machine as well, too. And, you know, whereas previously your bank account, and as part of the idea of you having a bank account that it was facilitated, you were charged a transaction charge on your account, all right, like, and people had that, but there's also various ways of you could reduce the transactions in your account and stuff like that there too, and so I think that should be dealt with as well, and you know, and the companies that provide the cash machines should be forced to deal with the banks, because everybody that uses a cash machine is in relation to a bank account or a credit union account or whatever they got there, and that should be streamlined, and should be that process should be dealt with there rather than dealt with at the point where you're using the card.
And just by the by, I have noticed a number of businesses that say we're going cash only. We won't accept cards anymore because of the costs and so on and so forth. Do you accept their right to do that, or do you think, just to be fair, that all businesses should also take card payments?
Yeah, I think they probably should take card payments, and that's something that needs to be dealt with by the government as well, and how the banks charge customers for using. So I know that there is so much charge per. I'm not exactly sure what the percentage charge is out there, but per using transaction can be, and it probably affects businesses that don't have a lot of usage. As well, probably the volume of usage of cards and that there is what affects it. But I mean, everything we should be doing, we should be making it more accessible to citizens, and for citizens to be able to use the payment methods that are there. And if it's a point in the future that we decide the cash is no longer available and no longer going to be, we'll then come out and say that and make that the case as well.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for your time as always. Independent Deputy Thomas Pringle there. Have you a view on that? 086 60 25,000. Is the WhatsApp and text, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. A caller says, if we get rid of cash, there'll be no staff in the bank. I see everyone using machines. Older people sometimes only have cash. Nobody seems to care about the older people who can't use cards. I don't go in and out of banks too often, but the last time I went into it, well, the last two times, the first time I went into a bank to lodge a cheque, and I was directed to a machine where a member of staff showed me how to use the machine to lodge the check, which I don't know what the purpose of that was. That person could have been behind a cubicle and lodged it for me, I suppose. But I presume the idea being that we do all that stuff ourselves. And then the most recent time I went into a bank, it was like something futuristic. It wasn't like a bank I remembered anyway. And it was just machines, really, and very few staff. And I wasn't a member of that bank anyway. I had to leave in the end. So the businesses like coffee shops that refuse to take cash, I wonder, do they also refuse tips in cash, says the listener. I totally agree with Deputy Pringle. GEA is not accepting cash is a disgrace. But another caller says they'll gladly take your cash when they're selling you tickets at your door. Well, that's the other side of it as well. Right, we're joined on the programme now by Professor Paul Dunlop, Research Director, Geography and Environmental Science. Good morning to you, Professor Dunlop. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
With us also is Dr. Andreas Lehmann of the Swiss Federal Laboratories for Materials and Science Technology. Good morning to you, Andreas. Good to see you again.
morning. Yeah, nice to see you too.
Right, okay. I'm going to allow you guys to sort of divvy out who speaks on what here, because I'm out of my I'm out of my intelligence peer group. So we'll start with a new science paper. It's called Cement and Concrete Research. So who wants to outline, you know, what this is about and where we're making the advances? Do you want to go with that, Andreas?
Well, yes, this is our second paper that we have published on the so-called mica crisis that deals with the defective blocks that affects the homes in Donegal. So in this project, we looked at four homes, one that is not damaged and three damaged homes. And we have investigated the block work in the internal and in the inner leaf and outer leaf, the rising blocks. And we had some samples from foundation. And the paper summarizes the microstructural analysis and the degree of deterioration that we have found in the different components.
Now, pardon my ignorance. If the three, the fee... I always struggle with this one. The freeze-thaw theory, which is currently used by IS465, if that is not the case, what impact does the environment have on the deterioration? Because we do see, obviously, the external leaf deteriorating far quickly than the inner leaf, the foundations or the rising walls, for an example. So what's happening in the atmosphere that is triggering this reaction on these blocks?
Well, you're absolutely right. We see different degrees of deterioration in different components. So what effect has the environment? What we're dealing here is a pyrotite oxidation that releases sulfur into the concrete. This sulfur reacts with components of the concrete and forms new minerals that lead to expansion and strength loss. Now, just imagine you drive a nail into a barn on the outer side and the inner side. The outer side, of course, is exposed to the water and it starts to rust. This is actually just what happens with the pyrotite in the outer leaf. There is oxygen available, there is moisture available, and the pyrotite rusts and releases the sulfur and starts this attack. In the inner leaf, the moisture level is, of course, lower, and this entire process is slowed down. However, we see the same thing as in the outer leaf, the same process in the rising blocks. It goes slower there because there's less oxygen. There's a lot of moisture there, but there's less oxygen. So the environment really affects how fast this reaction proceeds.
So whilst mica isn't the problem per se, Paul, and again, pardon my layman's terms, does it have a function in that it's the delivery system or the conduit, or has it no function at all in this crisis?
Yeah, well, I mean, it has a function. So when a manufacturer is mixing concrete that has aggregates, that has mica that's liberated into the cement paste, water gets attracted to the surface of the mica flex, and basically that creates what's... You need to add more water into the cement to make it mixable, okay, to make it workable. Okay, so what mica does is it creates a concrete that has a high cement-water ratio, and some concretes like that are more porous. So what mica does is it has a role to play during the mixing phase where the water demand is increased. And then when it becomes hardened again, you end up with a more porous concrete. And that those pores allow access to moisture and oxygen to basically connect with this pyrotite crystal. So it has a role to play, but it's not causing the cracking. And we have found no evidence, and when I mean we is in the research paper, but we're involved in a wider piece of research with Laval University, University of Connecticut, and Concrete Research and Testing Labs over in the US, and none of us have found any evidence that there's a freeze-thaw process impacting on the concrete samples that we were sent from those defective homes. And very interestingly, the home that was not defective has quite a high percentage of mica in the concrete. Actually, it's higher than what the banks set for mortgage lending on the market, yet after decades, that house has not impacted. It's been sitting in the same environmental conditions as the three defective homes that have pyrotite in it. So therefore, it's got the same access to temperatures, like whether it's freezing or whether it's thawing. It's got the same render thickness as the other three homes as well too, yet it's not cracking. So we're fairly confident that that there's mica freeze-thaw is not the cause of this. But when we look at the detailed microstructural analysis, which is like a forensic analysis of the concrete, we find all the evidence for internal sulfate attack, including the byproducts that are in there, these sulfate salts that are created.
I'm not trying to distract from the major issue, and it's probably the exception rather than the rule, but given what you've just said, is it possible houses are being worked on that don't require work? If the only test is for mica and high levels of mica are found, and maybe they're in a group of properties and it's presumed it's defective concrete, that we could be tossing houses that don't need to be tossed at all?
Well, I would say that's very highly likely. I'm contacted a lot by people who are trying to sell their homes, so people who can't get onto the scheme,
yeah,
say they're outside, and they're always reporting back to me that there's no cracks in their house. Mm-hmm. They send their engineers reports, there's no cracks, the house is 25, 30 years old, yet they're being tested for mica, and it comes back with 6% mica, no iron sulfides, no signs of degradation or cracking, yet the banks won't allow that house to be, they won't lend a mortgage on it, house can't be sold. So there are groups of homeowners in Donegal that are trapped in homes that they can't sell, all because the original idea that mica freeze-thaw was causing this issue is wrong. And also, it's also highly likely that we all know at the minute, because of IS 465 is flawed, and that's widely acknowledged. It's not just me saying it, engineers are saying it, the politicians are saying it, the scientists are saying it, the homeowners are saying it. You know, everyone is getting the decision based on the wrong damage mechanism. So the significance of the research project that we've done is that we have found a very clear, consistent diagnosis of what the problem is in Donegal defective concrete. And the entire scheme now has to wrap around that.
But surely the argument at this point now, Paul, though, should be, and it maybe even should be the government that's pushing this and not campaigners, is to pause this scheme until IS 465 is updated. You know what? I know there was some talk of 2 to 5, but surely the whole lot should be paused at this point until such time as we know precisely what future decisions will be made on.
I mean, if they want to do it correctly, now that they've got a clear diagnosis of what the problem is, they should pause everyone's decisions. There's a group of people whose homes are being reassessed by the housing agency, and I've seen those reports. The housing agency engineers, there's a number of companies that are employed, are assessing the home's risk to freeze-thaw and mica percentages in the concrete. I've seen the petrographic laboratory analysis that are attached to those reports. The houses are full of pyrotite, and they're just ignoring that completely. So it makes sense to pause that completely. But also, there's homeowners that have had decisions made based on IS 465 that really need reassessed as well too. Andreas can talk about that as well, what he thinks, but that's just my opinion on it.
Yeah, Andreas, I want to ask you too, and you can talk to that in a moment if you don't mind. What is the situation then as it relates to foundations? I don't know how foundations are supposed to age, if you know what I mean. But obviously foundations are the same concrete potentially, but used in a very different way. It's not porous. It doesn't have the same identifying factors that you've talked of as a block. And it's a big conversation as part of the redress scheme. So, you know, we've seen houses with defective concrete, and then we've had a look at their foundations. I don't know how long we expect them to last, but are you still of the belief, or were you ever of the belief, Andreas, that foundations would have to be changed? Or has this new research pointed to the fact that perhaps they will be sufficient for the natural life of what you might expect for a house?
Well, you know, what we have seen in the research project, and we have tested these foundations of the four homes, three affected by pyrotite oxidation internal sulfate attack. You see this process in the foundations as well. However, it's at a very initial stage after 20 years. And on the current database that we have, I mean, these are just these three affected homes that we have investigated, we cannot say for sure how this reaction will proceed in the future. It's clear there's a risk for this reaction.
But we must get a strong 20 years in the ground. We must get a strong indication as to you know, I mean, I know you're a scientist, right? And you're not in the game of speculation. But if after 20 years, the foundations seem relatively okay, would you anticipate they would last another 100 years?
I won't say this, but it's clear for me, if I would own a house that has had this situation, I personally would replace the foundations. Yeah. Because, you know, you always have in the back of your mind, if there could be something that still happens, yeah, and your new home that is based on all foundations that have pyrotite in them. I mean, this is easy, not easy to get out of your head.
No, of course.
So,
and of course, too,
it's psychological aspect,
the decision,
I would replace them.
Exactly. And not even that. I think actually the what will drive this is the market, not necessarily the science in this area. Because if I'm going to buy a house and it's been rebuilt and it's on the old foundations, obviously that house has a lesser value, or it feels like a risk, and that's going to impact its sale value. Yeah. Paul, I'm sure you would agree on that.
I agree with that, because I was talking about homes that have been tested for trying to be sold because they've got small percentages of mica being stuck in the market. I mean, the entire conveyancing system in Donegal is also flawed at the minute. I think it's the testing is done on an ad hoc basis. I've seen multiple reports coming sent through to me, different groups of people doing the analysis, different numbers of samples being taken, no foundations ever tested on that. So you don't get a clear picture of actually what's happening in the home. Now, I have consistently said to the political leaders here, the different action groups here, and also to those homeowners, that they need to go back and have a conveyancing system similar to what they do in the UK and south of England, called the Ricks Mundig. It's the Royal Institute for Chartered Surveyors. They have a procedure for conveyancing for homes that have pyrite in them, and it's an agreed process that the banks then lend on a certain percentages. But they have a testing protocol to test for the correct damage mechanism. So we need something here in Northwest Donegal, at least anyway, because of they're still testing for mica. And they're also using IS-465. IS-465 is a protocol that was designed to test for damaged homes. It's not meant to be testing homes that aren't damaged, which is sort of being retrofitted into this. You know, and there are so many problems with conveyancing and also the scheme. You rightly said, you know, about the banking sector. I mean, the homeowner groups have been working with the banking sector. They had a working group with the Department of Housing, but the Department of Housing have closed that down. They were working with the Bank and Insurance Federation of Ireland. Mm. That's been just completely stopped down, because it looks as if the government just don't want to deal with these issues, and it's wrong.
Yep.
I mean, the banks really should be putting pressure on to get that group up and running again to try and find long-term solutions.
Yeah, for sure. And often, you know, when we talk about these issues, we're talking specifically about those that are affected by defective concrete, but this actually widens this conversation out to every house in the county if you ever had any intention of selling it. So that's why it's more important.
Well, you've probably heard people saying, oh, I had to get a mica test done to sell my house. I mean, it drives me mad.
I know. And some people might have been told that they've got, you know, 7 or 8% or 6% of mica, and they can't sell the house, but the house might be perfect. It's just got high levels of mica.
For 40 years, not a crack in it, you know.
But what is the situation there? Because a listener texted in, they actually sent it to me on Facebook, and we'll get back to this in a second. But their house has been up for 20 years, and they do have some cracking on one corner of the house and mild cracking elsewhere. If a house has been up for 20 years and it's not like we see in the images, are those images the worst case scenario, Paul, or is it still probable that that person might have defective concrete? Like, is there any... There's no hard and fast rules in relation to that. If you walked up to a house that was 20 years old and one corner was cracking a bit, you know, when there was some hairline cracks and elsewhere, would you say, oh, that's defective concrete? Or would you, what would you, your view be in your experience?
Concrete cracks for different reasons. You know, you can have subsidence, for example, in a home that can cause cracking. you can get cracking in the plaster through just sort of no shrinkage in the plaster. So it's extremely important for homes that have cracked, they not be looking at them. Visual inspections of these homes don't really tell you very much. There are very obvious ones and obvious signs that you've got defective concrete because there are different stages to the internal sulfate attack. The first phase is where you get an expansion and cracking. But the second phase is when you start getting strength loss and crumbling. And, you know, that's when thomasite is being formed and the thing's just falling apart.
Yeah.
You know, people could be at an early stage for different reasons of this process, but the only way you can find out is if you take cores and you do petrographic analysis.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why testing is very important. But it's also really important to have a testing protocol that's looking at the right damage mechanism. So that's why this research project has been so important. And, you know, this was funded by Department of Housing.
That was my next question, because, like, where... This, and either Andreas or yourself, Paul, who has this information? Because if this is being funded effectively by government and it's very, very detailed, obviously, and tells us an awful lot, and it's sitting on the desk of those that are reviewing IS465, there's only one possibly one outcome there can be, surely, to the review of IS465, Andreas.
Sure. Our results have to be taken into account, and I would like to really point out this information that we provide in the paper. It goes further than what has been published by us in the first paper, but information that mica is not a culprit, but it's pyrotite and internal sulfate attack. I first presented this in March 22 in the European Parliament, and even people who not were informed about that or they didn't care to get the information, it was clear at, let's say, the latest at the conference we had in Letterkenny, November 22, what the real cause of the failure of the blocks is. And me as a scientist, I'm highly frustrated that people haven't picked this up faster and still stuck to the mica crisis, because this is really awful. And I just think, me personally as a scientist who continuously tries to learn, this level of ignorance for me is just unacceptable.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you what. The research is being submitted to Geological Survey of Ireland, who then submitted it across to the NSAI and Department of Housing. So it was a Department of Housing funded project, effectively, and it was designed in such a way to feed science directly into the NSAI TC63 committee, who are revising IS465. Now, TC63 are mostly engineers. I think there's one or two geologists and some technical people who should understand the details of this. But they also had a say in the sample preparation. So we didn't take the samples. TC63 committee members, along with Geological Survey of Ireland, picked the houses, picked the sampling locations, and asked us, go ahead now and analyze the concrete. And the concrete samples were sent to four different research groups within our consortium, and also another independent group of people called RSK, an artisan lab in the UK. The idea was, do multiple scientists find the same things, or do you find different things? And the results that are coming back from across the spectrum of research scientists is the same. It's internal sulfate attack, it's causing the issue. So that's who's getting science.
And on a completely unscientific basis, I stopped outside a house yesterday. I had to, because it looked so bizarre, whereby the external leaf had been taken down, and it was sitting there, and it seemed so much more hassle to do it that way and messy. And it you thought, surely there's no sense to this, that we're stripping this house of its outer layer, and when you see it left there, it looks like something that's been bombed or something. It's just it doesn't seem to make sense.
More seriously, I think the research that's been done in this research project, I mean, the publication is just one part of it. We have very detailed reports that have been sent in to NSAI and GSI over the last year. You know, we have clearly demonstrated that internal sulfate attack is happening on the internal walls as well.
Yeah.
And the rising block walls. So I think Andreas's analogy of hammering a nail on the outside and on the inside,
yes,
it rusts quicker on the outside, but it also eventually will rust on the inside. So the process has just slowed down. So,
and there are certain insulating systems. And I talked about this 3 or 4 years ago, and it didn't seem to be a big deal. And maybe it's not a big deal now, but I was contacted by people who had a, you know, the walls pumped with certain types of insulation, and very soon thereafter noticed cracking on the inside of the house. I don't know if that was a carrier of water into the inner block, but I mentioned that a couple of times in interviews and it was never picked up on. Andreas, yeah. Is that going to be a factor as well in that, you know, if you have something that can transport that moisture into the tip of the nail quicker, it'll rust quicker on the inside?
Yeah. This is correct. And I mean, the strange thing is, or I have to point out that all the internal walls are standing on these rising blocks as well, and there is moisture. So, but what I have to point out as well, I mean, the three homes that were affected that we initiated in the project, it was clear all the block work would have to be removed if they would have been repaired. Did make sense. But of course, these were three homes, and we are material scientists. At the end, the decision has to be made by engineer, taking into account all aspects of a home.
Yeah.
It was clear the homes that we investigated, they were just, yeah, had to be.
But that engineer's demolished. Decision has to stand. Yeah. What, yeah, we're seeing is engineers, yeah, making decisions and those decisions being, yeah, overturned, and that's part of the problem. Andreas, we're out of time. Dr. Andreas Lehmann, thank you so much as always for joining us. I appreciate it. And having to dumb it down a little bit for some of us. Professor Paul Dunlop, thank you very much indeed as well.
No problem. Thanks, Greg.
Take care of yourself, gentlemen. Thank you for that. Now, we have some great prizes for you today and all week on the 9 till noon show, thanks to our friends at Green's Shoes. They've got stores right across the county and country, Letterkenny, Falkara, Limerick and Galway. And they're also online, a very easy-to-use website, greensshoes.com. Now, our prize today is a pair of genuine Dr. Martens. So any of you out there who are shoes fans will know that they are a very desirable and not too cheap a product because of the quality, of course. Let me see some of your comments. Some of them are quite long and we don't have a lot of time. But this caller says, I can't believe what's being allowed to be shown on X. It's so shocking. The violence is so brutal and teenage and children can access it with such ease. There should be some kind of censorship. X is toxic. Firstly, for the extreme political views one way or other. I'm not even going to mention lefts or rights. It's right across the board. But it's full of pornography and it's full of extreme, extreme violence. And I would not like my children anywhere near it. So I fully agree with you. But that is the price of free speech, you see. It's a free speech platform and that means absolutely anything goes. And if your kids are affected by it, well, that seems to be a price they're prepared to pay. They're almost like collateral damage.